Welcome. This is Victoria Schneps from Schneps Media and bringing you today a true A-lister, Mr. Christopher Giancarlo, who helped me with his crypto dad talk at the Palm Beach Chamber of Commerce begin to understand the power, the impact of cryptocurrency. I'm delighted to have Chris Giancarlo with us today. Christopher wrote this wonderful book called Crypto Dad, and I think he made it as a dad because he can educate all of us about this complicated world of cryptocurrencies. So I really, with no further ado, want to say hello and welcome to you, Chris.
Oh, thank you so much. May I call you Vicky? I understand that's what your friends call you, and I'd like to be one of your friends.
Thank you. Well, you know, I am a curious person. I think to be in the news business, we got to be curious. And when you spoke recently at the Palm Beach Chamber of Commerce breakfast at the ungodly hour of 8 a.m., I was able to start to begin to understand this world of cryptocurrency. And I felt my readers, my listeners in this case, would also want to know more about this subject. And you just are plain spoken, you know, like Harry Truman was a plain spoken president. We all understood him and he got right to the point. So I know that you have journeyed down to Palm Beach, but that you are a New Jersey, New York man. So you started to share with me how you got into understanding and being part of the crypto world. Because your journey is always fascinating to me to how to be where you came from and where you are now. So let's talk about it.
Sure. Well, thanks. So I grew up in northern New Jersey, the son of a New York physician. My father was an otolaryngology physician, the chief of surgery at New York Eye and Ear Infirmary for many years. My mother was a nurse. But my parents were always very entrepreneurial. My father, in addition to being a celebrated head and neck surgeon, was also a founder of numerous businesses in healthcare, as well as numerous medical devices. And so I have three brothers, there's four of us, and we all went into some sort of form of
business. Well, first of all, I've got to say, this is a brave woman. I don't know if she's up in heaven now, but you know, to have four sons is, you know, they adore my sons. I love him. He loves me. He has no criticism as my daughters do. So sons are wonderful for mothers, but that's a lot of energy in that house.
It was. And my parents demanded a lot from us. It was that kind of, they were well matched, my parents, two A-type personalities. Very loving, but very, very driven. And they instilled that in their four sons as well. I like to joke that my father wanted all his sons to be doctors. He pressed so hard for my older brother that eventually he became an engineer. my father pressed me a little less intently. I went into law. My next brother, he still pushed him, but not as hard. He went into business. He gave up on the fourth son, and of course, he became a physician. So
the baby. So my husband was also a doctor. He was a nephrologist, and he had four children, and he had the baby, became the doctor.
Exactly.
Interesting. No pressure. That's why.
I think that's right. Yes. I think that's right. I became a lawyer, and I started on Wall Street, and I spent 16 years practicing law in New York and in London. Mostly representing technology companies doing business in the United States. In the year 2000, I went into business with a group of entrepreneurs and built one of the world's first digital networks for trading a complex type of over-the-counter instrument called a credit default swap. And we raised...
What was the concept that made that a possible thing to create? What was the... the seed that made birth to the flower.
Yeah. So it was an instrument that was traded pretty much over the telephone. It was traded by large banks with other large banks, and they would use brokers to help them find a bid or an offer. And our concept was that we could marry those human brokers with analytical tools and computers so they could trade more directly online and ultimately in a fully automated fashion.
Too much technology, but okay. Too much information, but this is fascinating. How from nothing, you created something.
Whenever there's an opportunity for those who are bold enough to create a solution, there's an opportunity.
And that's a lesson in life, don't you think?
It's worked every time, I think, for entrepreneurs. And for us, it resulted in us taking the company public in 2005. And it was a very successful opportunity. By the time of the 2008 financial crisis, our firm carried 80% of the world's over-the-counter swaps markets on our systems.
Oh, my.
Now, we were not a trader. Right. We were the exchange, the things that didn't trade on the exchange. And when Congress took up the Dodd-Frank legislation, we were actually very supportive of it. And I issued a statement when it passed, at least that portion of it that concerned the credit default swap market. I don't think the Dodd-Frank Act is perfect by any
stretch. A lot of banks hate that.
A lot of banks hate it. In some ways, it nationalized the banks. You might argue that the purpose of Dodd-Frank was to transfer power from Wall Street to Washington, at least power over the American banking system. So one can complain about it, and we can have that conversation another time. But there's a portion of it, Title VII, that I think worked, and I put out a statement saying so. And that led President Obama to appoint me to the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
It's nice to be chosen.
It was wonderful, and I was unanimously confirmed. I was quite surprised when President Trump renamed me as chairman of the agency, and I was unanimously confirmed a second time around, which proves that Congress probably doesn't know what my commission did, or I hadn't annoyed enough of them in my first term of office.
Well, you must share about when you testified before Congress, what it was like with the buttons.
Yes.
I love how you described that.
So giving a congressional testimony is really a unique experience in many ways. And many of these senators and congressmen deliberately intend to intimidate the witnesses. That's part of the game. And they've only got their 6 minutes to harangue and make their point for the cameras and for their constituents at home. And similarly, the people giving testimony only have 6 minutes to give their opening remarks to set the tone for what they're going to discuss. And in December of 2017, my agency created, the first time in the world, a regulated market for any type of crypto. We created the Bitcoin futures market. It was actually created by the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, but we green-lighted it through the commission. And I received a summons pretty soon afterwards to appear in front of the Senate Banking Committee to testify why on earth I would have allowed this product to go forward. Of course, in preparing for this, I prepared a 50-page briefing document with 200 footnotes explaining everything we did. But as I was preparing to give that testimony, I realized I needed to get through the politics and talk to these senators. And when you appear in front of the Senate Banking Committee, it's strategically set up so that the senators sit on a raised dais. Behind them are all these bright lights. And you're placed down on the floor at a very low table. So you've got to crane your neck up to look at all these senators that are looking down on you in a very dour fashion. And so when it came time for me to speak, I pushed aside my big stack of papers in front of me. And I said, "Senators, I know I'm here as the head of a powerful government regulatory agency. But if you don't mind, I'd just like to talk to you as a dad." And I put aside my glasses and I stared up at them and I said, "You know, my children, I've been trying to interest in the stock market since they were kids with no interest. But all of a sudden, all they want to talk about is crypto. We've just come back from a family ski trip. And every night around the table, my nieces, my nephews, my kids would say, 'Uncle Chris, tell us about what's going on with crypto.' And as I looked up, I could see a few nodding heads. And I said, 'You know, senators, maybe a few of you have had the same conversation around your dinner table.' So I said, 'I think that we should respond to this interest in a thoughtful, intelligent, and a mature fashion and not simply dismiss it as a childhood fantasy. I think we owe it to our sons and daughters and grandchildren to give them a responsible regulatory framework for this and not try to brush it aside.'" And with that, my Twitter handle just exploded. I had about 700 Twitter followers. Within the next 72 hours, I had over 50,000. And they gave me all these nicknames. And one of them, Crypto Dad, is the one that seemed to stick.
Love it. Love it. Well, I think it's the plain talking that you've got a great gift to be creative, obviously, but also to be able to put it in layman's language. So where are we? If you could explain to our listeners, what is cryptocurrency today in the blockchain world?
Yeah. So I think the mistake that makes this so complicated is people think about it as some funky new investment asset class, like some sort of new form of digital gold that we're going to invest in. And is it up? Is it down? Is the price volatile? That's true in the same way that Tesla for a long time was an exciting stock to be in. But Tesla was so much more than just its stock. Tesla was a whole new way of transportation, an electronic car future as opposed to an internal combustion engine future. What made Tesla so exciting was, if you believe the future of driving was electric vehicles, then Tesla was the best way to express that vision of the future. What makes what's so unique about crypto is it's much more than just some sort of new stock to invest. It's really a new architecture of how you and I preserve the value we've accumulated in life. It's a way of recording who owns what and who's transferring what to who.
In a way, we're doing that now.
We're starting to. So right
now, in terms of, you know, when you have to buy a bond or something, it's recorded.
That's a very good, that's a great way of thinking about that. But the bonds are all issued, they're recorded on different balance sheets. So my retirement money, whatever I've managed to save up in this lifetime, I've got with Fidelity. Now, it's not stacks of $100 bills in Fidelity's basement. It's an IOU on Fidelity's balance sheet. And God forbid Fidelity went bust, that money's gone. Now, government may step in with insurance, FDIC, others to insure it. But the fact of the matter is Fidelity was the only one recording my retirement, and now Fidelity's gone. What crypto is saying, instead of recording value, instead of recording your retirement, instead of recording your checking account on a bank balance sheet, instead of recording your ownership of that automobile on a county registry office, instead of recording the title to your home in some mortgage office somewhere, let's record all that value on the internet. So what we really need to think about crypto is less as an investment asset class and really more as a new architecture of finance, a new architecture of banking, a new architecture even of money itself, an architecture that's internet-based. If you think about it, Bitcoin or Ethereum are no different than HTML or HTTP. They're protocols for recording value on the internet in the same way that HTTP or HTML are protocols for recording information on the internet. And we're going to go into a period of time where these different protocols are going to compete for primacy, just as those protocols, HTML, HTTP, were questionable as to whether they would be the leading protocols when they came out, but eventually they emerged. And the same is happening here. This is a internet-based architecture for recording who owns what and who's transferring what to whom on the internet, as opposed to the way it's been done for the last 400 years, where money and things of value are recorded on the balance sheets of either commercial or government agencies. There's nothing inherently eternal about recording value on the balance sheet of a commercial institution. It's kind of odd that, in fact, 90% of money is recorded on a bank balance sheet. Why is that? The 90% that it's an account and not cash is on some bank's balance sheet somewhere. And those banks, as we saw just in 2023, three of the largest bankruptcies of American banks took place. And with that, but for insurance, all the value on their balance sheet went with it.
So I think it's a very challenging time of thinking about this as an internet money, that you're accessing it and knowing how it's protected with people like, you know, I'm at the point where you want to protect your assets. How is it guaranteed to be protected? Because from my perspective, there's not a securities yet rules to control the activity of people involved in this kind of exchange.
You're absolutely right, Victoria. And, you know, we've been through these architectural changes before. 150 years ago, the only means of getting down to Palm Beach from New York City would have been by steamship or by railroad. And that was a week's journey. But we took that for granted, that that's how you got here. Then a new system came along, the airplane. And now it's a matter of hours to get back and forward. And with that new means of transportation, all new rules had to be developed. Aviation authorities needed to be developed too. provide rules of how you transport through the skies, and air traffic control systems, et cetera, had to be developed. But we did it. And similarly, with this new architecture of finance, we will need to develop all those new rules and protocols. It won't happen overnight.
So you think it's something that's not going to go away by regulation, that the regulators are not going to find that this is not a form that can be allowed to continue?
Absolutely not. In fact, I just want to read to you some figures that I just got this morning about where we are. So as of this morning, as of this interview, so we are here at February 15th. Bitcoin has once again become a $1 trillion market, has a $1 trillion market cap with a bigger capitalization than Walmart, Tesla, or even Berkshire Hathaway. It's also broken above the $50,000 level again that it hasn't been at after 2 years. We've seen impressive inflows from the Bitcoin spot ETFs of about $500 to $650 million a day. And Fidelity has announced that 1-3%, they will put 1-3% of their allocation in their all-in-one conservative ETF of cryptocurrency.
Wow.
So notwithstanding all the regulatory hostility, which I'll come to in a second, crypto is not going away. In fact, once we've allowed it to go into people's 401ks, it's never coming out again. Now, I think the current regulatory hostility to it is secular. I think it's transitory.
Well, I think that, don't you believe it's also part of ignorance? Yes. It's kind of like, I feel like my brain is opening up a new content, is filling in space that I've opened, and yet not everybody has opened their brains to it.
But I also think it's about control. I said before that I think a lot of what Dodd-Frank was about, the rise of Washington and its control over the financial system, over Wall Street. And I think having gained that control over the traditional banking system, our leaders in Washington do not wish to yield that to a new generation of entrepreneurial activity and an internet-based system of value and finance.
So is politics getting involved, or is it the ignorance of people because they're not educated yet?
I do believe that right now we're seeing a policy-driven hostility to digital assets and crypto by this administration, a policy that has not been provided by Congress. And in the absence of congressional action, I do think you've got this administration generally hostile to crypto.
And is it hostile because you think of ignorance?
No,
of
I don't.
The subject?
No, I don't think
what
so.
What is the fear?
I think this leadership in Washington very much understands the power of this new architecture to disrupt traditional players. You know, when the Internet of Information came around, the first wave of the Internet over the last 25 years, great American giants like Kodak were tremendously disrupted, American newspapers, American journalism. But those institutions, those industries didn't have the same type of power base in Washington that the banking industry does. Mm. And I think that banking industry combined with political institutions that are supported by that industry, that are to some degrees captive by it, are very resistant to this innovation.
Let's take that point a next step, because yep. I understand that kind of political power of the banking industry not wanting to see a disruptor, quote unquote, come onto the marketplace. But yet, couldn't that be embraced as another way that they store money so that it's more not as threatening to them as an institution?
Vicky, I think you're absolutely right. What I advocate is that America should return to its innovative roots, and we should do this in an intelligent, smart way. We should be aware of the disruption, but we shouldn't let that hold us back.
So when you're talking about not holding us back, I think that the world is going on without them. What did you say? How many trillions of dollars are in cryptocurrencies?
You're so right. I've just come back from Europe. I met with the head of regulatory agencies in the EU, in Switzerland, in the UK, they see America's hesitation and hostility as a commercial opportunity. Europe has passed an important new piece of legislation that will make Europe very hospitable to innovation. The UK is doing the same thing. Meanwhile, we in the United States seek to protect the institutions that dominated the financial institutions that dominated the 20th century. There's no question the American dollar, the American banking industry, American forms of financial regulation dominated the 20th century. But, you know, new technology can change all that, and it will. And our economic adversaries and our economic competitors see this new technology as a way to bypass that infrastructure of the 20th century that we were so successful at, to make them successful in a new 21st century.
So explain to me how that would impact on the economy, the fact that you have a different way of handling your currency. Because that's basically what this is. It's almost creating a new form of currency, correct?
Well, our current system, as functional as it is, as supportive as it has been for the American century of the 20th century, is actually quite expensive. It's quite slow. It's filled with friction, and it's filled with rent collecting behavior by a lot of financial institutions. Right now, it costs 7 to 17% to transfer money around the world. It's cheaper today. If you want to get it's easier today. If you want to get $10,000 from here to London to put the cash in your suitcase and get it on an airplane, than it is to actually wire it or transfer it. It'll take days for the money to get there. It costs the world, I've heard estimates of between 1 and 2% of its GDP, global GDP, just to move money around the world. Well, guess what? Once upon a time, it cost a lot of money to move information around the world. And now we do that at the swipe of a mouse. If we can move information around the globe in an instant, why can't we move value, such as money, around the globe in an instant?
So I think it's almost like when we were taught in school, this is a dollar, this is a dime, this is a nickel, this is what we do, and this is how we use money. It sounds to me like there's a need for a whole new education system on letting people understand how this can be useful to them, and maybe including the banking industry.
Well, what's so interesting was you talk to young people that grew up in a networked world. They understand all this intuitively. It's our older generation that grew up with passbook savings accounts. I remember my friend go to the bank, put my money in for mowing lawns, and they'd stamp my passbook savings account. I remember my first checkbook and balancing my checkbook. Young people have bypassed all that. They want to know if I can send a game token from an online game playing to my friend in France in an instant, why can't I send him money as well? Why is that system antiquated and everything else in this new digital era automated?
You know, it's a fascinating new world of how we live, because money is a central piece of our world. And, you know, how do we get the word out? You know, I'm always trying to educate my readers about what the latest things and trends and happenings are. How do you see us actually? This is implementing itself without regulation. It's just happening.
So when I was in government, as chairman of the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission, we created a very well-functioning regulatory framework for derivatives on Bitcoin and ultimately derivatives on another crypto called Ethereum. And now 5 years later, the system we put in place, it operates very well. Those markets are liquid. They're deep. They're transparent. They're well regulated. We proved in 2017 that regulators that wish to engage successfully with crypto can engage successfully with crypto and can do it in a very well regulated manner. It's about tone from the top. It's about leadership. Europeans can do it. Why can't we Americans do it? Right? This is the first time in my life where Americans are resistant to innovation and Europeans are open to it.
Well, I mean, we call that the lobbying groups of people who have a vested interest in, you know, in keeping the status quo. And I think that's what's exciting about this shakeup of the status quo. And I think the idea of being able to educate our communities about cryptocurrency is critical, because I think it's going to come no matter what resistance comes from the government.
I fully agree.
Because it's in place.
You can never stop technology. You can try to resist it. You can try to hold back. But eventually, it's like water over a dam. You try to dam it up, the water will find a way around. This technology is not going to change. I'll give you just a historical analogy. When the printing press first came to Europe, the end of the Renaissance, the beginning of the modern era, those cities that were resistant to it became the backwaters of Europe over the next 200 years.
Oh my.
Those cities that embraced the printing, and as disruptive as it was, many people argue that it was the printing press that broke the Catholic Church's monopoly on truth and allowed for the Reformation.
Yes.
And it caused centuries of turmoil, but yet you could not stop it. But those cities that tried to stop it became the future backwaters. And those cities that adopted it were the ones that marched ahead. And I'm so afraid the United States, having dominated the world financial system of the 20th century by resisting this change and all the disruption it will bring, but by trying to resist it, won't actually stop it. All we're going to wind up doing is making sure we're no longer the leaders of the world's financial system in the 21st century.
Well, I know the big piece of it is I watch Squawk Box every morning and I see the tape going and what's going up and what's going down. And I don't know, that Bitcoin is a crazy number. How do people invest in this? I know you mentioned that you're not investing because you want to be able to be an authority without prejudice for the crypto world.
That's right. Yeah, I do not own crypto. It was a policy I took when I was chairman of the CFTC. Since I was making rules about it, I felt it would be inappropriate for me to benefit by the rulemaking in any way. I've kept to that policy since I've left government. I own no crypto because I'm an outspoken proponent of this innovation. What I would say is some people see the volatility of Bitcoin as a design flaw. It's actually a design feature. And let me explain.
Wow. Okay, wait, say that one more time. Because
It's not a design flaw. It's a design feature. And here's why. Whenever you have a fixed supply commodity, which Bitcoin is, Bitcoin, the DNA of Bitcoin, it's written into its very code that there's only so much Bitcoin. You cannot create more than is allowed in the system. Therefore, it's a basic law of economics. When you have a fixed supply of a commodity, only one thing can happen if demand goes up or if demand goes down, and that's price movement. The reason why Bitcoin is so volatile is because it's a fixed supply, and therefore any demand will or drop in demand will drive price up or down. Look at oil. Oil, which is not a fixed supply, but it's still a limited supply, is a very volatile product. Oil now is close to $100 a barrel, but just 2 years ago during COVID, it was below zero. Oil is very volatile, but we don't say, therefore, because it's volatile, it's illegitimate. What we do is when the price goes up, we pump more oil. But in the case of Bitcoin, we can't mine more Bitcoin, and therefore it has a volatile price. So what I say is it's not a design flaw, it's a design feature, but it also means as an investment asset class, one needs to know what they're doing. And I would not put your rent money in a volatile asset like this. But if
save your rent money, everybody, for now. Wait. It may be coming point where you'll want to, but not yet.
Exactly.
So if there are other ways to invest in this new world, and maybe it's not so new, maybe I'm new to understanding it, but the world of cryptocurrency, Bitcoin is one of the ways people are investing in this world of cryptocurrency.
That's right.
Are there other ways to invest in it?
And I like investing in Bitcoin to investing in Tesla over the last few years. It wasn't that Tesla was the greatest company on earth that made its price so high, although it was a good company. It was the fact that if you believe that the future of personal transportation was electric, then the way to express that view was to own Tesla, or at least one way to express that view. And I think if you believe that the future of money and finance and banking is going to be internet-based, then the one way to express that view is to own different cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, Ethereum, or Solana. And what I won't do is ever give it investment advice. As a former regulator, and you know, you never know where life leads. Who knows? Someday I might be back into government. the last thing I'd ever want to do is try to tell people how to invest their money. What I do say is same advice I give my children is follow traditional guidelines about for more speculative investments, only invest the money that you can afford to lose for the money you need for your rent next month or for your tuition next year. You keep that in safe and liquid investments and be prudent with your investment approach.
Well, I think this is a wonderful way for Christopher Giancarlo, who wrote The Crypto Dad, giving us dad's advice, guys. We just got it. We did. But we also got educated. So I want to thank you so much, Chris, for being with me and sharing some of the facts and understanding. You've got such a wonderful way of making it, I don't know, like, okay, I think I get this. So thank you for being with me.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
This is Victoria Schnepp saying goodbye till next time. Love you.